athletes don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Welcome to the Health Science Coach Podcast. My name is Drew Garner, and I'm a health science and physical education teacher. This is a podcast to help students, parents, and recent graduates learn about pathways into healthcare and sports medicine careers. These industry professionals lay out how their experiences have helped them get to where they are now. If you enjoy this content, please subscribe to the channel or download through your podcast player. Thanks again for spending some time with us today. Now let's dig in. Welcome, Daniel. You, how are we doing today?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. Hey, so you're joining us today from Lawrence, but you're supposed to kind of be down in Florida. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, what you do as a sports scientist for the Mets and kind of how you're able to do both things as you kind of finish up your master's there in Lawrence.
Yeah, so a sports scientist, at least for me right now, it's kind of like, well, I'm remote, but when I'm in person, a lot of it is just like testing and monitoring the players. So you might hear the terms like load management. Like when you're watching the NBA, you'll see some players sitting out, and it might not always be because of injuries. It might just be because, oh, their load is high. So it's kind of just making sure that they're not too stressed out in terms of physiological or mental levels. You work with a lot of different healthcare providers within the team. So you have your high performance unit, you have like your director of performance, and then you have your ATs, your PTs, your strength coaches. It's kind of, as a sports scientist, you're kind of working with every single one of those facets. And then you're collecting data from each of them and kind of putting that data together to form a holistic picture. And throughout all of it, you kind of have like a scientific outlook in terms of how you form your questions or design your experiments, if it comes to that, yeah.
Yeah, so each kind of player is their own experiment, sort of, if you will. Where you're dealing with, you know, one guy may have a rolled ankle or another guy may have a shoulder issue. So it's not going to be the same data for each player.
Yeah, for sure. Everyone has their own data, especially when you hit that professional level. You want to look at everyone individually, right? Because we respond to stress differently. Everyone's their own person. So yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. So in person, you know, we just kind of got talking about spring training starting up and the Mets being down in Florida. You're finishing up your master's and going to defend it here shortly. And we're going to talk about what your research is for that. But you know, once you get down to Florida, what is a typical day in the life kind of look like for you as a part of the Mets?
Yeah, a lot of
the or first half, a week in life also. Yeah. Kind of.
Yeah. So players only come to the facility for X amount of hours. So whenever the players are there, it's really important to just get to know them as like people, right? Like you got to get buy-in for them. But outside of that, a lot of it is like testing and just monitoring. So a lot of hands-on stuff. Mm-hmm. And then once the players leave, a lot of the time is actually cleaning the data. So whatever you collected, it has to be put into like a certain format. Just so like when you do want to run statistical analyses or you have a research question that you're ready to ask, you're able to readily pull that and ask those questions. So I'd say the first half of the day is a little bit more hands-on. And then the second half of the day, you're kind of dealing with data and cleaning and working with other aspects of the athlete picture. Yeah. Kind of like putting it all together.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like research in a way where you have data collection initially when you're running your research project, and afterwards you're running the stats, right? And then doing your report or write-up.
So with teams traveling, you know, once the baseball season starts and, you know, spring training's finished, I'm guessing you'll be housed in New York then?
I'll still be in Florida. So I'm with the minor league system. So
okay.
New York will be our AAA and our AA teams.
Right.
But our low A is in Florida, I believe, as well as our complex site. So I'll be based primarily out of Florida and just work the minor league system. Our major league has their own sports science.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So two separate teams in minor league and major league. As a part of traveling, do you travel with the team when they go places, or how does that kind of work? Or you hang back and work with the guys that are still at the complex?
Yeah. I think we play by ear a lot. Sometimes we'll travel with them. We have other members on our team as well that we might take turns traveling. But if you do travel with them, it's kind of just the same thing, like making sure that you're monitoring the type of load that they're doing. So we get the feedback live, which is pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. So you're in Lawrence now, and you're going to be headed down to Florida. Originally, you're from New Jersey. And in high school, you were your salutatorian. You were the class of 2016 graduation speaker and vice president of the National Honor Society. And you also were captain of cross country. So that's a lot of different experiences you were able to have in high school. How did your passion for sports kind of lead you to going to study at University of Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, UConn, basketball capital of the world. I grew up watching them. I know I'm in Lawrence right now. Let's go Jayhawks. That's in the Final Four now, but UConn, it is what it is, you know? So been at two big basketball schools now. But actually, one of the main factors, and I would strongly urge any students to do this, is cost of school. Okay. That is extremely important. You don't want to have debt. Like, no matter how great a school is, that is a really big factor. So UConn was one of the cheaper options on my list.
Right.
So that was the primary reason why I went. But in terms of academics, they have a really strong exercise science program. But I actually initially went there for biomedical engineering because I was pre-med and I was really interested, really strong biomedical engineering program as well. I was really interested in like biomechanics and how it ties back to biology. But then after my first year of biomedical engineering, I was like, I kind of want something a little bit more hands-on in terms of relating back to human performance. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that really reflected in the faculty and the student body as well for the exercise science department. So I transferred over there. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And that's where you ended up getting your bachelor's in exercise science and human performance from. While you were there, you had a couple different experiences working as research assistants. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a two-part question. How did you go about looking for those positions, and what did you do with those two different positions?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think out of like my entire career or everything that I've done so far, one of the hardest things is getting your foot in the door, no matter what it is. So even if it's research, the hardest part was just that initial part of, because your experience is zero. So you're not really helping out a lab when you first join, although you will eventually, but when you're first joining, you're just learning everything. So it's kind of up to the director of the lab or the PI that kind of accepts you into the lab or doesn't. Unfortunately, I had an amazing PI, Dr. Lee at UConn, and she kind of took me under her wing and then really mentored me throughout research and all of that.
Right.
But yeah.
So the PI is the private investigator, right?
Yeah. The primary investigator for any research project. So the same as like the director of the lab. So
right.
I would, there's different ways of going about it. You could email them, look at like research that they have done and then say like, why you're interested in that research and how it ties back to your passions. Because if you're joining someone's lab, they want to know that you're committed to it. And another way is through your faculty. So the classes that you take, if you're able to build a relationship with your teachers, a lot of times, especially at teaching universities, your teachers will do research as well. So you can just run up to their office hours and be like, hey, I know that you do this and this. I'm super interested. And then maybe that'll be another way as well. Or there's classes as well, like independent studies that you can sign up for. And that's also a really great way to get that foot initially in that door.
Yeah, I think that's a great opportunity by, you know, talking to your professors and instructors and seeing what they've done and just asking them questions. I took some classes there at KU with some of the same professors you have, Dr. Fry, and that's kind of when me met up. And so through Dr. Fry, you know, there's a lot of people that he knows that we're both able to connect and communicate with as a part of that networking culture. And some of the tests you did while you're there, you know, you did some VO2 max heart rate testing. You worked with a U.S. Army funded study. You were able to do some data collection and analysis with nutritionists and other exercise scientists there. Were there any different studies that you can talk about as far as like the long-term studies you may have worked on as an undergrad?
Yeah. There's a really big heat lab at UConn. It's called Corey Stringer Institute. And a lot of the research that you read related to heat strokes or heat exhaustion or a lot of athlete safety stuff too, it all comes out of that lab. So the military funded study was actually performed in their heat lab. I believe it was a grant that they received from the military looking at, like, they're going to a very warm country, and in our heat lab, you could adjust the humidity, right, as well as the heat across a huge spectrum. So they would put participants in, like, military uniforms, and they would run on, like, a treadmill or do, like, a VO2 max, depending on what the study was. Right. I wasn't really involved in designing any of those studies, just because at that time I was still, like, an undergrad and just learning. Yeah. I was just doing whatever it takes to get my foot in the door. But, yeah, it was just really awesome being able to assist with those VO2 max studies, stuff like that.
I was able to work on some while I was at KU in the Energy Balance Lab. And kind of same experience, you know, while you're beginning, you're not running your own studies. You are just helping with the PI studies or the other people there are working there in the lab. And so, like you said, getting your foot in the door is a really big experience to show them that you are interested and this is what you're interested in doing.
For sure. And it builds also, just because you don't have that much of a say in this initial project, when they see you continuously, maybe you'll have a larger part in the next one. So my next research experience that I kind of did have a larger part in at UConn was my statin project related to my thesis. So we looked at C. elegans, which are like these microscopic worms, and then I would ground up these pills, and then I would feed it to the worms, which is kind of cool. But and then we would look at muscle and neuronal damage over time under a microscope, and they're fluorescent. So you turn all the lights off and you'll see these little worms like glowing in the dark. But I think that's also a big distinction to make between research. You have like the ones that are a little bit more applied and hands-on, like you're in the lab doing like VO2 max tests and working with humans. And then there's also the more translational wet bench type research where you're at like a wet bench top, it's like the classic, you got your goggles on with the pipettes and you're working with like mice and worms. But yeah, it's really cool to see the whole spectrum being able to experience that type of research. Yeah.
And so you said that was a part of your thesis for undergraduate. And that kind of leads into your experience that you got as a university scholar there. What can we talk about, you know, the program that was talking about the undergraduate and masters and how that university scholar program affects what you were able to accomplish over there at UConn?
Yeah, so I think university scholar is a really competitive program that you have to apply into, and it's open to every single undergraduate major. So I was an exercise science major, but you would see people in like biology majors or even like chemistry and engineering majors that are also university scholars. And essentially, they only accept 20 out of the entire undergraduate body. So you have to write a grant, you have to write a thesis proposal, it has to be approved, and then depending on that, then you're accepted or you're not. But once you're accepted, you have the option to take graduate level courses, and they count as graduate credits. So every year, there's a couple of them that do graduate with master's degrees within their first 4 years. So if we count the amount of money that costs and they actually save, it's a tremendous amount. So I think I don't know if every school has it, but I believe most schools have a variety of a program somewhat similar to that. Like every college should have an undergraduate research office where if you are an undergraduate and you want to get involved in research, that's also a great way to get involved. And they'll also have like different programs like that you can enroll in. And oftentimes, a lot of the students publish their research as well, and it's it's a great opportunity.
So, as you mentioned before, you said that you know you were pre-med for a long time, and before you really kind of made that decision to switch over to exercise science, what kind of led you towards that path, other than you know that those classes your freshman year, and how did that kind of that pivot really open your eyes up to other opportunities?
What led me towards being pre-med or away from pre-med? Away from it. Okay. Well, what led me away from it was not getting into med school. But, So it took me, like, when I first got to UConn, I always wanted to be a doctor. So for 4 years, that was, like, my one goal. So I committed a tremendous amount of time and energy. All the research I did was for getting into med school, as well as all the extracurricular stuff, being an EMT, volunteering patient care hours, shadowing physicians. That was all to become a doctor. I didn't get in, unfortunately, which sucks. But honestly, looking back, it's been a huge blessing because it allowed me to take that time to, like, reflect. And at that time, I was super stressed out as well. Oh, it was like, what do I like about this? What do I don't like about this? Will I be able to survive if I don't end up going to med school? So, and, like, failing in that aspect has been great because now I found sports science, and the work that I did building up to med school allowed me to pivot. So I think oftentimes when people don't hit that one goal, or at least me initially, I was like, wow, I did this all for nothing. It's been such a waste of time. But really, it isn't like that at all, because all those experiences made my resume strong enough to actually go towards, oh, well, while I was at UConn, I worked with the football team. And I was like, I really enjoyed those moments. And that led me to learning what a sports scientist is. Like, I didn't even know that was a job. But through these little experiences, it helps you see what else is out there. So yeah, I would say it's okay to fail, especially after 4 years of committing yourself to something. It's more so how you recoup and bounce back from that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. By working with the football team too, you know, that was kind of towards the end of your time there at UConn, and you know, you said you were able to see what a sports scientist is and what they actually do as a part of the wellness team of the athletes and the programs. Working with the UConn football program, what were you able to do as kind of a researcher for them, as well as being a student, kind of like a student assistant, I'm imagining, or a TA?
Yeah, so the hardest part, once again, is just getting that foot initially in that door. So I emailed one of their strength coaches, and I kind of used, like, my background of working in research at the UConn Human Performance Lab. I was like, hey, I can do this, this, and this. I'd love to come and learn and see what I may be able to potentially help with. Like, I'll do whatever it takes. And gladly, they responded, and they're like, yeah, come in. So what we did there was, there's these things called GPS units. They're super common now. They're like, they're winning basketball, soccer, football. But it's pretty much like these tiny little pods, and you'll wear them in the back of your shirt. You'll see, like, sometimes you'll see pictures of guys in vests, like sport bras. That's typically when they're wearing a unit, but that'll track the amount of distance that they're running, the speed, the amount of accelerations, decelerations. So once again, it just goes back to measuring different types of load. Right. And my primary part in all of that was running the analytics of that data, like seeing how we'd be able to use it. And also just because you have so many guys on these teams and they're all wearing these units, and the units are sampling, like, what, 20 times, 10 to 20 times a second. So you're getting a ton of data, and it's an immense amount of data. And it's hard to manage that data as this one person on the team. So I was really able to bring value by kind of just being there and helping clean that data up and put it into a format that they wanted to see it in.
I can totally imagine that now in my head, you know, looking back at my experiences, and other people that play sports can see this also. But you know, if you're doing conditioning or whatever it is, and you have 50 guys out on the sideline, there's going to be one or two that are slacking more than the other one. Not doing as many reps as the other guys. And by looking at that data, you're able to see, you know, who is working hard, who is overworked, who's overtaxed from maybe they went too hard yesterday. And, you know, today they need that load management, as you talked about.
Yeah. 100%. And load management isn't just about holding people back. It's kind of like what you're saying. If you see some guys that are slacking off, you'll grab them and be like, hey, man, I need you to push it a little bit harder. Or, like, sometimes we want them to hit a certain speed, and that's how we hold them accountable, right? Because we're not going to be in the middle of the field and set up some timing gates or whatnot. It's just like, but we just have that unit. We have an iPad and a beacon, and it'll just tell us live. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Does that track heart rate data or skin temperature levels, or is that completely more data from different things?
Yeah, that's a different technology, but we're there. Like, there's a Polish shops that you can track heart rate live as well. I believe Gatorade has a skin patch that I know for sure it measures hydration.
Right.
But there's also patches that measure temperature as well, which are pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be pretty interesting to look at all of those combined and see what that turns out to look like as far as, you know, people participating in sports, not just college athletes, but, you know, those higher end, maybe triathletes that are doing stuff on their own, or, you know, not just school NCAA or professionals.
Yeah. And that's kind of what you do as a sports scientist. Like, you have data coming in from these different departments. Let's say like hydration is doing the hydration tests, the sweat patches that they're wearing, that tells you like how much they're sweating per minute or per hour. And then you have like strength and conditioning that has like the amount of tests that tells you how fast they are. And it's kind of like your job as a sports scientist to bring all that data together and kind of create a holistic picture of how the athlete's doing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So after your experience at UConn, going from one basketball school to the next, what kind of led you to want to come to Lawrence, and how did that process kind of play out?
Yeah. I think somewhere along my senior year at UConn, after I didn't get into med school, one of the biggest things I learned was networking. So it's just like talking to, whether it be professionals in the field that have the jobs that you have, and sending them just the message on like advice. Like I can't remember the amount of cold emails and messages that I've sent. And oftentimes you do get ignored, but once in a while you'll have these guys that do respond, and it's some of the greatest advice that you can get because they're actually in the field. They know exactly what they're talking about.
Right.
So when I went after UConn, my biggest thing was I want to go somewhere where the people that are, I went for the people. So there's two primary people that brought me to Kansas. The first one is Dr. Fry. So you know Dr. Fry as well. A really big heavy hitter in the research field. And he's just got this really awesome sport performance lab. And it was at this point as well where I was messaging sports scientists. And I was like, oh, this is actually a job. And I was learning about what they do. So that's kind of the research side of it. And I was like, okay, well, I need a guy that's super applied as well, that like works with athletes daily. And we do work with athletes in the lab, but it's kind of the way you look at things is a little bit different. It's kind of more from a research side that might take a little more time. And from the practical side, it's like, what can I do now that can instantly make them better? And the other guy is Ramsey Najum, also has a doctorate, but he was the Sacramento Kings head strength coach for a while, but now he's the head strength coach here at KU, which is really awesome. So those two people were the primary reasons I came. Before I came, I sent them both an email. I was like, hey, would I be able to be involved in whatever you guys are doing? And good responses. So then I was like, yeah, KU, sign me up.
That's awesome. Now, yeah. UConn, I think UConn has Andrea Hootie, who was KU's former strength coach here as well. Did you work with her at all while you were at UConn?
Oh, I missed Andrea Hootie by one or two years every time, because she was at UConn and then she came to Kansas.
Yep.
And then when I got to UConn, she was at Kansas. And then when I got to Kansas, she went to Texas, and now she's back at UConn. So full circle, maybe that's my next step, you know, got to go back to UConn.
There you go. Well, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. So reaching out to Dr. Fry and the head strength coach there at KU, you were able to, you know, get in the door. You obviously applied to KU. You're accepted. Let's talk about your research fellowship with the Performance Nutrition and Research Fellowship there at KU.
Yeah, so that was like my graduate research assistantship last year. So it was, well, that was the thing. I messaged Dr. Fry and was like, are there any research positions that are really applied in like the athletics department? And that was a position that was literally based in the athletics department. So we take body composition for every single athlete. And it was within the nutrition department. So from the DEXA scans, we would see lean body mass, bone mass, fat mass. So you see a greater picture than just like a skin fold measurement. But from there, it's also kind of just like painting a holistic picture of how the athlete is doing. Right. You take it throughout the year as well. So it's like how they're adapting as well. So yeah, that was an amazing experience. And then in that environment, you get to talk to nutritionists, strength coaches, athletic trainers, and just kind of just pick their brains on how they see athlete development. And kind of, once again, you're putting that whole picture together.
So for our listeners that are, you know, in high school and college that are thinking that a sports scientist might be something that they're kind of into, while you were doing that, you did a research paper that got published on developing a prediction model for bone stress injuries on distance runners.
Yeah.
We're looking at, you know, the cross-country team and maybe some mm-hmm. of the staff members that do some of the longer distance stuff. With those DEXA scans, you're able to see, you know, their bone density as well as their muscle tissue and fat tissue.
Mm-hmm.
What can you talk about as far as that study and what you were able to find with those runners?
Yeah, so I think when there's this thing called needs analysis that you kind of go back to for every athlete population, right? Like everyone's an individual, every sport has different demands. So in looking at cross-country runners, one of the biggest injuries that they run into is bone stress injuries. So stress fractures, oftentimes that's seen as, it might be an energy deficiency, or it might be they're not recovering properly, like they're running too much or they just don't have enough downtime. But there's so many different factors that go into it. It's really hard to tell sometimes. But what we used was our DEXA data, and we kind of fed it into regression. So regression is a type of statistical tool to help predict injuries. And then we had injury data for people that were coded yes, they did have a bone stress fracture, or no, they did not have a bone stress fracture. And then through that, you're able to feed in different variables that we have collected through DEXA. And then you can see, this is able to explain like 90% of the variance as to why someone might have a bone stress injury. Okay. So by feeding in different variables, you can see how well your model accounts for that. And essentially that's what that study was looking at. It was saying, what type of variables in our DEXA data do we collect that could potentially help predict bone stress injuries?
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Really, really cool study. I think a lot of, there's a lot of sports science studies getting published, or more and more looking at ways to predict injury. And one of the biggest takeaways is it's really, really hard to.
Well, that's good to know, because there's so many injuries that happen all the time with athletes and, you know, people that are training or exercising on their own that are participating in, you know, extracurricular activities, you know, triathlons or marathons or that kind of stuff, that, you know, they have those little injuries and nicks and bugs along the way that, you know, maybe there is something out there eventually that will come from these type of studies with high performance level athletes that will help, you know, other pretend wannabes like me.
Yeah. No.
So after that, you got a research assistant position, same place at KU. You kind of did some 3D motion capturing systems, with shooting and pitching and jumping, did a hyperbaric oxygen for sport recovery and performance study. Kind of leads into your master's thesis. Let's talk about how you kind of chose that as your thesis topic and what that research looks like.
Yeah, so the Drew has been a huge part of my master's thesis.
Little part.
In terms of finding trained participants, Drew has been a lifesend. So my study is looking at this. I think it's about like 8 feet, right? Like 8 feet long, a hyperbaric chamber. So it increases pressure and it increases oxygen. And we hear like all these anecdotes from these really great athletes like LeBron James. And I think a couple weeks ago, I just saw an article that Ronaldo bought one as well.
Okay.
Michael Phelps uses it. So we're just covering every sport at this point. But
right.
Really elite athletes use this hyperbaric chamber. And it's kind of like, why? I guess that's, yeah, that's the question. It's like, why are they using it? Because the research out there is, it's still pretty new. Hyperbaric oxygen research has been used for many years now in hospitals. It's used to treat like wound healing and crush injuries. But in terms of athletic performance, a lot of the research data just isn't there yet. But actually last month in February, they just published a paper looking at repeated effects of hyperbaric oxygen. So right. over 8 weeks, 40 sessions total, and they did muscle biopsies, and they saw an increase in mitochondrial mass, as well as an improvement in VO2 max, the anaerobic threshold, and something else that I can't remember, but it was like, they're like, oh, this is very conclusive. It's going to improve aerobic performance, which is pretty cool. Yeah. But yeah, I think there's more and more research being done. But I kind of, mine is way simpler than that. No muscle biopsies, but you just lie in the chamber for an hour, and we measure your tissue oxygen saturation, how much it increases by, how much it decreases by, the rate that it increases by, the rate that it decreases by. And we're looking at it across training status, so a trained individual versus an untrained individual, and males and females as well.
Okay. Yeah, it was really interesting. Like you said, I was able to participate in that study, and you know, you go into this tube, and I'll post a picture of what this link is to the tank, and you kind of just lay there, and you feel it. You, like you said, when we were walking us through the study, it feels like you're going underwater, and you're just kind of laying there, and the pressure just kind of feels like you're being soaked in by the water. Obviously, there's no water in there; it's all air, and you kind of just sit there. And it was, I mean, I listened to a podcast while I was in there, and just kind of sat and hung out for an hour. And you had that thing stuck to my leg, and what was that? All was that measuring?
So that measures your oxygen levels. So you have your pulse ox that will measure your arterial oxygen saturation. That's typically going to be around 98 to 100. But your tissue oxygen saturation fluctuates quite a bit, so that'll be far lower, like around 60 to 80 or whatnot, and then we'll see it increase quite a bit. So the primary mechanism of the hyperbaric oxygen chamber is it increases pressure, and it increases the amount of oxygen content breathed if you have like an oxygen concentrator or oxygen mask. And that will increase the oxygen delivery to your tissues. Right. And because of that mechanism, people think that it might help you with recovery or performance. But we just need a little bit more on that in the published literature, yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
So is it, like you said, around 60 to 80, is it the more oxygen you have in your tissues, is that a better thing for athletes? Or how does that help by having that concentrated level of oxygen in the tissue?
Yeah. Theoretically, I would think that it would be better. Honestly, I'm not 100% sure. They've looked at people where they breathe oxygen during exercise, and they found improvements in like time trials, VO2 max, time till exhaustion. So the thought process is always the more amount of oxygen that you have, it should improve performance. So a greater percent of oxygen saturation should help. Although it's hard to tell if oxygen even is the limiting factor as to why you're not performing. Sometimes it might be something else that gives first and not oxygen. So yeah.
Right. That, like that VO2 max. So you got a couple more weeks now here in Lawrence. You're going to go head off down to Florida. We've kind of talked about what you're going to do as part of the team down there with the Mets, you know, with the minor league baseball system. What is it that you now, as you're getting into your career, what are you finding that you just really love about your job?
Yeah, I honestly, my biggest reason why I went into sports science, or why I chose to pursue it, is because it really combines my two really big passions, one being research. I just love the scientific process, as well as human biology as well, particularly pertaining to human performance. So I was able to combine those two with sports science, and then it's such a fast-growing field as well. Like, even just talking about the brief technologies that we talked about, like, every year you're getting something new, and teams are always trying to push the edge to become the best. So every day is honestly different. It's like there's never a dull moment, and you're always just trying to see, like, what you can do better. And I love playing with tech as well. They're just, like, toys. So it's just, like, I get paid to do what I love, and it's amazing. I love it. Yeah.
That's awesome. As far as misconceptions about, you know, sports science and research scientists, what do you kind of see or have you heard out there before, like when you were getting ready to, you know, make that change in your career? What type of misconceptions do you think people might have?
I think a misconception of, that's a good question.
One that comes to my mind is, like, we've kind of talked about, you know, doing the wet lab type stuff where you're just feeding mice or playing with worms versus sitting and playing with the toys, like you've talked about, and teams using those different things like the GPS and the heart rate and the hydration tracking stuff. I think, you know, with that oxygen tracking, if you're there, wherever that leads to next. I think, you know, some people may think it's just sitting in and doing the data analysis and not really being the hands-on side.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Like, if you have, like, a stereotypical picture of, like, a scientist.
Yeah.
I think something that's emerging with sports science right now, too, is there's kind of two types of sports scientists. One is, like, a sports science and strength coach hybrid. And for those guys, you see they're super applied, right? Like, they're coaching, and if they're not coaching, they're testing or monitoring their players. And then you also have the sports scientists that are kind of more data analytics. They'll still do testing and monitoring, but on the other side, they're doing data analytical stuff. So it's kind of, and this just depends on organization to organization as well. That's the thing. I think something else people might think is that research is always super slow, and it might take like 5 years for something to publish. I think, especially in the sports science field, you'll realize how fast things move, because if it takes you a year to get something done, odds are there's going to be a new tech out there, new types of data sources. Everything is super fast paced.
And then this next question kind of goes into both of what you just mentioned, but, you know, as far as professional development, I'm sure that with the industry trends towards technology, you know, it's developing the product itself and then getting it out into the industry for people to test and use. When I was at KU doing my undergrad or my master's, we were used just accelerometers, and those were very basic little things that they wore around their waist, and it just measured movement, the 3D axis of movement. But now the GPS trackers of speed and acceleration, that's even a whole 10, 20 times level compared to the accelerometer itself.
Yeah. And we will have GPS measures that do have accelerometers in them. So depending on how you want to measure acceleration, sometimes you could pull it from the accelerometer, or you could pull it from the actual speed that they're moving at. So yeah, it just varies. Yeah. But yeah, things are changing so fast.
Professionally so far, you know, you're graduating with your master's soon. What do you think that, you know, in your career that you're most excited that you were able to achieve so far professionally?
Yeah. That's a good question. Honestly, I'm really proud of myself for the way I pivoted after I didn't get into med school. I think being able to deal with failure early on, well, not that early. It took me 4 years of undergrad, but still
early on in your years of, you know, failing at 20 versus failing at 28 is a big difference.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's good to fail early. There's no problem with it. You should embrace failure. All that matters is how you respond to it. If I were to just like have stayed down on myself for like a long period of time and not been like, oh, what do I really enjoy? Like, is this really, I think it gives you time to self reflect and see what you can do better. Like I said earlier, I think it's probably one of the best things that's happened to me, because it's amazing what I do now. And I didn't even realize that this was a field. So,
yeah. So as you currently self reflect, you know, getting ready to graduate, getting ready to head down to Florida, let's kind of look at your career in the next 10 years. You kind of, when you get ready to graduate, you kind of think you have your map, your roadmap's kind of set out for you currently. Where do you want to be in 10 years professionally?
Yeah, that's another good question. someone recently asked me how long I want to be in the minor leagues for, or when they think I'll make it to the major leagues. And what I said to them was, I love it in the minor leagues. The players are like, they're either fresh out of high school or college, so I'm really able to relate to them. Mm-hmm. Just from our age alone. And I think there's a lot more player development. Like, baseball is one of those sports that you see, you don't go straight from college into playing pro right away and making a big impact. Everyone almost goes through the minor league system for a few years. So I really love the aspect of player development. And I feel like I have a lot of impact right now because we're trying to develop these players to become like a major league caliber athlete. So yeah, I really love where I am now. I don't know. I feel like I have to experience different things to be able to say definitively where I want to be. But yeah.
Okay. Well, let's look at, let's go back in time 8 years ago to when you're a junior in high school. If you were a junior in high school right now in 2022, and you are kind of thinking to yourself, you know, you're wanting to go down that medical field and you want, you know, that's kind of something, and being a sports scientist is still in that realm. What advice would you give yourself as far as a junior in high school that would help you professionally now?
I would say get involved in research early. I think that's such a good fundamental like experience to have. Even if you don't end up going towards research, like just being able to think in that research sense, it's very methodical. And from research, you could pivot to so many different things. You could go into sports science. You could stay in research. You could teach. Yeah, I would get into research early from a professional standpoint. I don't know, from a personal standpoint, I just enjoy my time, you know? Spend more time with your friends. While you're still in school, I think I saw a tweet the other day that after you graduate high school or graduate college, 99% of the time that you spent with your friends in those times is done. So every time you see them afterwards, it's just part of that 1%. And they're like, cherish the time that you have with your friends then.
Yeah.
Because now that I'm in Kansas, all my hometown friends, we're all in different states. We all got jobs now. Same with my college friends. We all got jobs now. So it's like, yeah. I don't see them that much anymore. It's like maybe once or twice a year. So yeah, cherish your friends and the time that you have.
Yeah, that's I like that. As far as undergraduate advice for, you know, a sophomore in college that's thinking about exercise science and getting into it, what advice would you have for them as far as school related, study habits, groups, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I would say the things you learn in the field might take you a little farther than what you learn in the classroom, and you'll learn a lot better as well, just because when you're doing something in the field and you're actually doing it, it's hands-on, at least for me, and you really learn it. It really gets ingrained into your memory because it's like, oh, this is how I apply it, this is how you do it, and you feel like you're making an impact, as opposed to in a classroom, still really awesome. It gives you like that basic foundational knowledge, but sometimes it's just harder to apply it. So going back to undergrad, same thing. Like, just get involved early, get your foot in the door. That's the biggest thing. Once your foot is in the door, everything gets easier from there because you start networking, right? You know the people. Yeah. They're able to refer you to other people, but the hardest part is just getting that foot initially in that door. Yeah.
And then my next question kind of pivots to any advice you may have gotten recently, you know, as getting ready to graduate, maybe a professor, something Dr. Fry or somebody else there at KU has told you as a part of going into a professional setting?
Yeah. Last year, my boss told me to not take myself too seriously, which has been amazing. And because, I was an intern and like, I was like, I have so much to prove, you know, like you're new in a position. All you want is like to secure that job promotion, like get offered a full time. So it's just like, grind, no work-life balance. You're pushing yourself to the limits. So yeah, I think the biggest thing, like, have some time for yourself. Don't take yourself too seriously. Have fun. Talk, like talk, be friends with your coworkers. It's like, it's good, you know? Yeah, that would be the main thing.
It's good. And then, you know, when you get down to Florida, you're going to be down there for, you know, till the end of the season. What is something that you're going to just really focus on, as a professional career, you know, starting out as your job after your internship, you know, getting that promotion and moving up with the Mets, just after your first year? What's something that you're going to try to focus on as a part of, working as a sports scientist with them and, you know, working, down there?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest thing, when I first get there, is probably just getting to know the players. Getting to know the players and getting to know the staff, seeing which areas I can help. I always see like the sports science staff kind of as like a one of servitude. Like we're here to help the players. We're here to help the staff. Whichever areas of need that they need help with, that's where I am, and that's what I'm trying to do. And in order to do that, I just have to get to know everyone first and kind of build that connection. And then once there's that trust, that's where you can really grow and start pushing it.
Yeah. All right. So this is a two-part question. It is a, if you like and if you dislike blank, then being a sports scientist is not the right career path for you. I have some ideas in my head. But if you dislike blank, then being a sports scientist is not the right career path for you.
Oh, man. If you dislike working with people, I don't know. Yeah, because a lot of it is just like interacting, and you have to be really good at communicating, whether that be your results that you found. But yeah, I would say communication is huge.
Good. And if you like blank,
if you like communicating, if you love to talk, and you're able to form your ideas really well, and you're able to build good relationships, I think you'll thrive.
Okay, good. Do you have a mantra or quote that you kind of live your life through?
I think through work, I forgot who said this, but they said athletes don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
And that's so true. I think that's also kind of true for everyday life as well. So like, just switch out people with athletes. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Right.
So yeah, I guess it's like being a good person. And yeah.
I've heard that quote about coaches also, and you know, you can switch that out with people and just everyday life. I think that's a perfect example of a way to live your life through.
For sure.
As far as social media or people that are interested in learning more about sports scientists, do you have any handles or other people that you think are good follows to listen to or check out?
Yeah, I think there's a Twitter page called like Sports Science Reports or something like that. I think that would be really solid. My Twitter is pretty solid too.
All right.
It's at Data with Dan, or if you guys have any more questions that are specific, feel free to add me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to answer any questions. That used to be me just sending cold messages left and right. So yeah, whenever I get a message now, I'm always happy to respond.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for this time with us and sharing your knowledge about sports science, and really appreciate learning all about it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
If you've made it this far into the episode, I want to thank you again for watching. Please subscribe, share, and comment below with any questions or comments you may have. If you're interested in more information about other professions within healthcare careers, please visit healthsciencecoach.com and talk to your school counselor or academic advisor. As always, stay happy, healthy, and live life with passion.